You're listening to Episode 0 of Season 7 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and I'm your friendly host. This is, of course, GNU World Order. If you've never heard this show, it is a technical podcast that releases on Ogg and Speaks and talks about all manner of geeky topics. In this particular episode, we'll be talking about, some announcements that I've got. We'll be talking about the presentation that I gave at Ohio Linux Fest and probably some other stuff, so let's get started. Well, you might have noticed the beginning music and the segue music of my show. That, of course, are the sweet strains of Fat Chance Lester, a very fine band that used to jam in New York City quite some time ago, tragically lost when they went out on a boat, actually, to sail the seven seas, and a piece of space junk actually fell into orbit, made it through the atmosphere, and landed, unfortunately, right on Fat Chance Lester's boat. It was a big loss for the musical community. Happily, just before they'd gone out for their cruise, one of the members had given me all of their tapes, all of their back catalog of just jams and stuff like that, not really edited together in any way. Since they've been lost and people have been asking me about the music on my show, I have found it in my heart and made time in my life to take their otherwise long-lost work and kind of make something of it. So the latest effort on this front is called Android, and the Android album is going to be released, or has been released, depending on when this episode gets released, on September 26th. So if you stop by astiopod.com/Lester, that is astiopod.com/Lester, and maybe as a way to find it even easier, I'll make a redirect from, slackermedia.info/Lester, and that way you can, if you don't remember the other name, you can go there. It'll redirect you over to astiopod.com/Lester. All of their, that's Skrillet's server, all of their stuff is being hosted on there. So astiopod.com/Lester, take a look at it. There's, I think, 4 albums out currently, so this is their 5th album, edited posthumously by me. Well, wait a minute, it's their posthumous album, edited by me. With all the, you know, some of the songs were pretty much straight up, just kind of like, oh, this was a good jam, I'll just do some equalization to it, a little bit of compressor or limiter on it, and release it as is. Some of them were complete mashups where I just found one phrase that I liked and I would loop it around and then take another phrase that I like and put that on top of it, all kinds of interesting stuff. Check it out. It's all done on free software, of course, specifically in this case, Slacker Media, and Audacity, strangely enough, for the main editor. I realize that Audacity is not a digital audio workstation and is not meant to be used the way that I'm using it, and yet it's just so effortless to get things done in that, so that's what I was using. I, of course, use a lot of stuff from freesound.org and archive.org, so it's really, a lot of it is just kind of a mashup of different sources. Either way, I find them enjoyable. I enjoy them. So if you do as well, then feel free to go download it. It is, of course, free and available in both Ogg and M4A. Not my choice, the band's choice. Of course, in their will, they did specify that it would have to be available on M4A's. That's a good thing they had that will right before they left. So yeah, it's available for free. I used to offer FLAC, but those are just such large downloads, and I don't think people were really using them, so I took those down, but if you absolutely need FLAC, I can post it somewhere. You can grab it and seed it or whatever you want to do with it. So check it out. See, what else have I been doing? Well, Unix Porn. Unix Porn, of course, is the website that I started some time ago as a lark for people to post screenshots of their Unix desktops, their Linux, Unix, whatever desktop. I wanted people to post them so that we could all look at each other's desktop and get a kick out of it. The reason I started this site really was, a while ago, it seemed to be something fairly common to hear all these hackers talk about porn all the time. It's still fairly common, but it strikes me that it used to be more common, and there was it always seemed like this weird sort of in-joke, like everyone was talking about porn, nudge, nudge, and I never really felt like I was in on that joke, because, I mean, if it is some kind of written rule somewhere that you're supposed to have X number of gigs of porn on your computer, then I'm afraid I didn't get that memo. So I wanted to have something to kind of deflect that joke, I guess, or to repurpose that joke and say that instead of that kind of porn, I had this porn, Unix porn, and it was going to be screenshots of desktops and terminals and Unix kinds of apps that I found interesting. And pretty quickly after I established the little copper mine front end on the domain, the free domain, I started letting people submit desktops, and they did. And before you know it, I had a couple of admins, The Last Known God 330 and Cobra 2, and they were kind of pimping the site. They were kind of talking it up. I mean, 330, I don't know if you know 330. You probably heard him on either Linux Cranks or maybe the very early Kernel Panic episodes. The guy knows how to market. He's a really, really great marketer. So he really talked it up. Cobra 2 did a fair share of talking it up on different places. Last Known God doesn't do anything. And so the site kind of started to get people submitting screenshots to it. And then, of course, Sigflup comes along out of nowhere and writes the coolest command line utility ever. You just type in yes, please, and the username and a description, and it takes a screenshot of your your current desktop and sends it up to your account on unixporn.com. And so two things happened. One you might already know about, and that is that it got free hosting. Before it was on GoDaddy, it was on free hosting deal, so they had all these Google ads and stuff like that. The thing about that is, well, twofold. One, that people think that those are my Google ads, and I'm not sure if they feel obligated to click on links or not, or whether they just think I'm weird like that and actually buy into the whole Google ad thing. I don't know. But either way, it is kind of distracting, unless you have Adblock Plus on, but not everyone does. Or if you do on your home computer, you might not have it at your other, you know, your work computer or something like that. And that, interestingly, brings up another point. People couldn't get to the site from work. Unix porn is kind of a flaggable name. Even the barest of internet filters is going to filter out a URL called Unix porn. So that was kind of an issue as well. The Last Known God donated server space, which was really, really cool. And we migrated the site a couple of weeks ago now, and it's up and running on a new free server. No ads, no cost to me or The Last Known God or anyone. It's just kind of sitting there, and it's great. It's got its own home now. So if you go to unixporn.com, you can submit screenshots of your desktop. As I've said before, it doesn't have to be anything spectacular. It doesn't have to have 3D effects going on in the picture. It could just be whatever you stare at on an everyday basis. That's what people want to see. They want to see real users using Unix or Linux or whatever you want to call it. So submit those screenshots. Be sure to grab the Yes Please utility, which is by Sigflup, great Hacker Public Radio contributor and a really great programmer and just an all-around fun person to be around. She wrote this command line utility. It works great, so try it out. And you do need an account on Unix Porn to try that, so if you do try it, be sure to get the account first. I think the new registration might be closed right now, so you might have to email me for an account. Point being, it's cool. Well, you might think, well, gee, Klaatu, I don't really like the name Unix Porn because it gets filtered by my workplace, or because my wife or my girlfriend doesn't like it, or because I don't like it. And this is a point that was brought to my attention first by Lost in Bronx and then by some guy named Rice Mark 20 or something like that. And it was kind of a, well, I don't like the name Unix Porn, period. No reason other than the fact that they don't like what I assume they think it is trying to say. And I realized that my original intent of grabbing hold of the word porn and taking it over and saying this industry doesn't get to have that word anymore, I'm going to make it a new word, might not have worked. I might not be quite that influential to completely reinvent an existing word like that. There's a lot of baggage that comes along with the word porn, and in no means did I mean to, or do I intend to, support the idea of porn. I was trying to repurpose the word. I don't think it's necessarily working for everyone, and in that sense, I don't think that it really works for me, because that's I'm not trying to further the porn idea. I wanted to detract from that, not sort of add support to it. Like, oh, look how cool porn is. We've even got Unix porn. No, didn't mean to do that. So now someone in IRC came up with the very wacky idea of calling the site Unix Puppies. I have no clue why. It just seems so random. I thought it was brilliant. So now there is it's sort of like a redirect. It's actually a domain being parked on the same server as Unix Porn. The Last Known God set this all up. I really actually don't know the way that it all works. I saw some Apache code that seemed to explain it, but I didn't really look at it that hard because it's not my Apache install, and I don't get to play around with that. So he set this up. It was Crayon's idea in IRC. Yes, there's a guy named Crayon, with a K, though. Maybe he's a big KDE user. I'm not sure. But Crayon had this idea, parking this domain, Unix Puppies. It was cheap to do unixpuppies.info. It was like $1.99 as opposed to $9.99 for unixpuppies.com. So it's unixpuppies.info. And if you go to http://unixpuppies.info, it takes you to the same Coppermine instance as Unix Porn is, but there's no Unix Porn. The URL is completely masked, and it's just it's unixpuppies.info. So if you don't like the term unixporn.com, perhaps you'll enjoy unixpuppies.info. Of course, after doing all of this, migrating the whole site to a new free server with no ads, as donated by the Last Known God, which I'm pretty sure I mentioned earlier, and also creating this parked domain that is unixpuppies.info, it was working just fine. Everything seemed to be perfectly normal. Somewhere along the way, I messed up compatibility of unixporn/unixpuppies with the Yes Please command line application. Now, Yes Please I have talked about quite frequently, both here and on Hacker Public Radio. I used Yes Please as the example application that I was building packages for in my HPR series on building packages for Unix and BSD. So Yes Please is a command line application that will take a screenshot and then upload that screenshot fairly automatically to your Unix Porn or Unix Puppies account. It was working great until I went along and changed some paths, at which point Yes Please broke. Luckily, it's a really easy fix, but if you're building Yes Please from source or from package that hasn't been updated yet, you will need to fix this manually in the source code. It is a really easy fix, trust me. All that you have to do is replace any instance of /screenshots/ with a simple slash. So basically what was going on here is that in messages.h, some kind of header file, I guess, I don't really know, it was, since this is a command line application for basically one thing, which is Unix Porn, it was hard-coded in messages.h that the post and the get activity from going online and getting feedback from the web, all that was hard-coded to, I don't know, /screenshots/updates.php or /screenshots/login.php or whatever. So in my progress of moving the site to a different server and establishing Unix Puppies, I realized that there was really no good reason to have the Coppermine gallery nested in a directory like screenshots. I'd done that originally because it's the first time I'd ever installed Coppermine. I wasn't sure if I was going to like it. I just kind of wanted to get it into its own little jail, as it were. So I put it into its own directory, and it's just kind of lived there for the entire time. But I mean, when I was migrating it, I realized that was kind of useless. So I just dumped everything out into the root, you know, the document root of that web server. So screenshots is no longer a valid, you know, should not be in the valid path. So in order to change that, you simply untar the Yes Please source, and the Yes Please source that you really should be using is the August 4, 2010 version. So if you download that, then you can tar-xf yesplease_aug4wildcard tgz, and then cd into yesplease_aug4wildcard, and then you can do /i/ /screenshots/_g:\.messages.h. That will go through really quick and replace all the paths. If the URL path in either a GET or a POST action contains the word screenshots or the string /screenshots/, then it just replaces it with a slash. I don't know how many people actually know this. I didn't know this for a long time until I really started using sed a lot more. But sed, I think a lot of us as geeks know the whole /string/replaceable/string/g command. That's like the sed way to find something and then replace it, right? So you've got sed dash, for instance, e, so that we don't actually do it in file, quote, /foo/bar/g, close quote, and then the name of the file that you want to do that on. That'll go through that file and replace any instance of foo with bar, and it will do that for every instance of foo that it finds. And the typical look of it, I think, is the /foo/bar/g. Turns out it doesn't have to be slashes. Sed is really flexible in terms of what special character you use as a delimiter in that command. So if you do a sed-e, quote, /foo/bar/g, quote, or if it's not global, you could omit the G, close quote, and then the name of the file. Then it knows that you're still asking it to search for foo and replace it with bar. And it doesn't matter if it's a slash or an underscore. I've even seen people do hash marks. /foo/bar/, close quote. As long as those delimiters, after the S and before the searchable string, and then after the searchable string and before the replaceable string, and then after the, you know, you need to close it after the replaceable string. As long as those three characters are the same, sed knows what you're trying to do. The advantage there, obviously, is that if you're replacing things like forward slashes, which are very common in path names and things like that, otherwise you'd have to go in and say /\\forward/ to escape the /foo/\\\bar, and then slash. That's just, it's really ugly and confusing. Whereas if you replace it with some other character, and it can be anything, $, underscore, whatever, just as long as those three characters are the same, sed understands. Anyway, that was just an FYI. So we've replaced all the instances of screenshots, the code is great, and now you can just do a normal /configure. Make install. So it's a really, really easy fix. Or if you're using a package manager to build from source, like Slack builds, or I imagine AUR or whatever that thing is on Arch, then you could do that to the source package, tar it back up, and then run the package manager against that source file. And that should work. That should work just fine. And then you can start posting screenshots to Unix Porn or Unix Puppies. Doesn't really matter, it's the same site, it's just a different way of getting to the same gallery install. So we've fixed a bunch of problems, so please go use it if you want to. Well, it looks like I just got back from Ohio Linux Fest. Actually, it's been about 2 or 3 weeks now, but around the same time last year, I was starting Season 6, so apparently my seasons begin and end in September, October timeframe, around the same time as Ohio Linux Fest. Good to know. Well, anyway, so Ohio Linux Fest went really well. It was a little bit smaller than the previous years, I felt. I think a lot of people felt that way. Whether that's a bad thing or a good thing, I'm not too sure. Frankly, I've never really understood the pressing blind need to get bigger and better. Not really sure the point there, except that I guess a bigger fest implies that you have a bigger user base. So in that sense, if world domination is your goal, then a bigger festival probably is better. But I'm not sold on the idea, because I'm not sold on the idea that everyone who uses GNU Linux necessarily goes to conventions, and people who go to conventions aren't necessarily users of GNU Linux. Heck, people who run the conventions these days aren't even necessarily GNU Linux users, so there you have it. Ohio Linux Fest itself was a lot of fun, though. You'll hear other people say the same thing, that the real reason behind going to a convention like this is to meet other people who can actually converse with you intelligently or semi-intelligently about the stuff that you can't really talk to about this stuff elsewhere. You can't just pull your friend aside at work, probably, and say, hey, what do you prefer, GNU-tar or BSD-tar, and why? discuss. It's just not going to happen. So it's very refreshing to get together with people who understand the intricacies of your OS or, you know, the environment that you're maintaining, whatever. So it's cool. And whether that's a matter of 100 people or 800 people, I don't know that it makes a huge difference. I'm not saying I want the next convention to be 15 people, three of whom are only there because their significant other dragged them along. But I am saying that I'm not sold on the idea that the success of a conference equals how many people were there. Either way, it doesn't really matter to me. I thought the festival was quite a bit of fun. Saw a lot of people. I missed a lot of people, too. A lot of people weren't there. Other people were there, but the time that we crossed paths was just the wrong time. But it definitely kept me busy. It kept everyone busy, I think. So mission accomplished there. I gave a presentation at Ohio Linux Fest, and the presentation went really well, I think. It was about Nova Cut and Final Cut and the industry and the users. And it was an interesting presentation, I think. I don't know that I had the right audience for it. I think that I was dreaming when I thought, oh, I'm going to talk to people in the industry and show them how flexible video editing really can be, and the process can be so much better and so much freer and stuff like that. I'm at the Ohio Linux Fest. I'm not at the NAB convention. You know, it's just not exactly the same. National Association of Broadcasters. Not quite the same audience. So I don't know that I had the exact right audience, but I think I was able to customize the talk enough to where it was applying to the audience that I did have. Got a lot of positive comments, a lot of feedback. Few people later said that they thought that I had rigged the presentation in a certain way. And so let me tell you about what I did during one part of the presentation. At the very beginning, I wanted to show people the competition, as it were. I wanted to show them Final Cut Pro, Final Cut Express, both of those two things, running on Mac OS, obviously. So I took a MacBook that I had from work, and I was going to open that up, and I was going to show them Final Cut Pro. I honestly had no ulterior intentions here. So I had the MacBook with me. I unplugged the Lenovo laptop that I had for the real presentation. I unplugged that from the projector and plugged the projector into the MacBook. I brought the right adapters with me and everything. I did everything I was supposed to, plugged it into the MacBook, and I expected it to be very hot swappable, just like my Lenovo was, and I plugged it into the video port, and it did detect the projector, but it did not at all detect the correct resolution. That's not that big of a deal. That's fairly common, I think. You know, no matter what OS you're on, it's not going to necessarily predict the resolution that you want. So I went to System Preferences, went to modify the resolution, and what do you know, the resolution simply was not available. It saw the projector as, if I recall correctly, an 800 by 600 device, nothing more. That's obviously not correct. The projector had up to at least 1280 by 800, so it wasn't correct. Trying to do a presentation at 800 by 600, especially something relying on Final Cut, just didn't seem very smart, but it was a bit of an awkward moment. I hadn't expected it. I'd honestly forgotten that sort of thing was an issue because I've been using a Lenovo and a Toshiba for a year now at my current job, and at one of the classes that I teach, I use those for all my lectures. I plug them in, I unplug them, no problems. No problems whatsoever. It detects the resolution options, I can switch over to them, no thought about it. So I'd honestly kind of forgotten that was considered impractical. So I tried to mess around with that a little bit, not too long, and I thought, well, okay, that's fine. I could have rebooted at this point, but I didn't think that was going to be necessary because I thought, well, I'm just going to open up Final Cut. I should be able to show them just enough of what I wanted to get across to them, just in regards to the typical video editor's expectations. Because I figured probably a lot of people don't really know how video editors use Final Cut. They don't see the workflow, and so it's difficult to understand what exactly the video editor sees that they're not getting on GNU Linux. So I really did. I was going to show them an honest portrayal of working with a Mac OS and the video editing tools on the Mac OS, and I did intend to show them Final Cut, and I was going to show them the codec issues that were one of the big reasons that I switched away from Mac OS in the first place, and even Final Cut as a video editing solution, because it was just impractical. It was just too much work to get the videos to work that I needed, you know, in Final Cut. So that I was going to be very honest and very sort of like, here's how it was. This used to be me before I switched to GNU Linux, and I was going to show them the good stuff and the bad stuff. So I launched Final Cut Pro, and the thing starts, or it appears to start. It starts bouncing in the dock, and it just keeps trying to start. And it felt like it must have been 5 minutes, although probably in real life it was probably more like 45 seconds. But when you're doing a presentation, obviously, any delay seems very awkward because you're just standing up there and you kind of have to say something or do something. And, you know, launching an application is usually not the part that you expect to fail, right? You think that's the part that's going to work, and then the application is going to not behave properly or it's going to crash. Well, the thing sort of crashed, I guess. I mean, it didn't crash. It did launch eventually, but it really took a long time, and the resolution was still only at 800 by 600. At that point, I decided to bail out and just sort of say, okay, well, that's the interface. Now let me talk about NovaCut. It was bad. It was not the way that I had intended it to go, and probably if the talk had centered more around that, I obviously would have done a lot more troubleshooting. I would have rebooted. With the projector already plugged in, that probably would have helped a lot. All the typical kinds of things that you would do if it was your computer. After it happened, I just sort of thought, well, no one really wants to see Mac OS at a Linux Fest anyway. I mean, I know I don't. So I just gave up and put the MacBook away. The effect of all of that, I mean, honestly, yes, I couldn't have planned it better, but it was not planned. I want to go on record to say that that was not actually how I'd planned the presentation to go. I did not rig it. I did not intentionally break Mac OS. It was absolutely, that was just how it happened in real life. I would tell you, dear listeners, if I'd planned it. Well, okay, maybe I wouldn't tell you, but I would. I would tell you if that was all planned, and it wasn't. I had no way to make the MacBook not recognize the external projector correctly when KDE on my Lenovo did, and my Toshiba does as well. Heck, if it's running BSD, my Toshiba does that, believe it or not. I've had free BSD on this thing, and I used it in class, and I would unplug and plug back in left and right, no problem. So I really had expected Mac OS X to do that. I'm not saying that every time you do that with a Mac OS X box, that will happen. It's a very anecdotal kind of, this happened to me at Ohio Linux Fest, and it did, sorry. That's what happened. And I couldn't really expect that Final Cut was going to take so long to launch either. So both of those things were admittedly beautiful mishaps, but they were entirely unplanned, and that is just, that's for the record, so that you know that it wasn't me bashing Apple. That was just Apple bashing Apple. It's really about time for a coffee break, but before we go, I want to make a point that I made in the presentation, and that is that if your users are telling you that they cannot and will not learn a new application, I don't care how many reasons they give you, they're bluffing. And I know this firsthand now, like I've never known it before, and I'm sure that this is probably applicable to other applications as well. But in the case of Final Cut Pro, there's a very, very famous right now, infamous thing going on with Final Cut where Apple completely changed the interface, completely changed everything about the application. You can look up for it online, you'll find so much hate about this, you won't know what to do with it all. So it's a well-known fact. It's not me making it up. It's not me exaggerating a situation. Something that's very, very popular to talk about right now. People really hate Apple for this. And people, video editors who swore that they would never look at another video editing application ever again in their entire computer-using life, the minute the new Final Cut came out, they were all flocking to Adobe Premiere, to Avid, you know, to the places they swore they would never go again, and they were downloading demos, and they were looking at prices, and suddenly they were ready to make, and still are, ready, and in some cases are doing, this leap over to a platform that they swore they couldn't be bothered to learn, couldn't be bothered to invest any time or money in. So Apple essentially called the bluff of every video editor everywhere. And for me, and this is a point that I made in the presentation, that's an entry point for free software video editors right there. It's the same situation, essentially, as Windows Vista. So Final Cut Pro X, you may call Apple's Windows Vista. It is a video editor that no one wants to use, and it's even cheaper than the old Final Cut, and still people don't want to use it. So, if you know a video editor, there are three programs that they should be looking at in what I would consider the order of readiness: KDN Live, VLMC, and Novacut. Those are the programs that right now are ready or near ready to absolutely replace Final Cut, both in style of work and options available. So KDN Live being the one that you can literally, it's a drop-in, it's not literally, it is almost a drop-in replacement for, say, Final Cut Express. No questions asked. I would replace that right now with, I would replace all the computers in the school with Slackware running KDN Live right now if given the opportunity. VLMC is not quite ready, but it's really, really close. It's a slick little application. Definitely take a look at it if you have not yet. And then the Novacut team is working really hard at getting their solution up and running. I think that's going to be more of a solution geared toward the networked editing crowd, people who need shared assets and things like that. So I think that'll be a little bit more specialized. Either way, it looks to be very promising. So free software is delivering. It's getting very, very close. In some cases, it's completely ready, like KDN Live. So don't let the users lie to you or lie to themselves. They are able and they are willing to learn a new video editor. It's just they need to be forced to learn the new video editor. Apple is kind of doing that for us. I think this applies to a larger concern, though. I think that it's not limited to Final Cut. I think that other applications are basically the same, in the same situation. People will tell you that they can't learn a new application, that they don't want to, that application lacks some killer feature that they absolutely cannot live without. And in some cases, I think that is true. And there's just no way around that, because I've witnessed that myself. I've seen people who really do use some feature of some Office application, or they talk enough to the outside world who uses that Office application such that the free replacement that normally would be perfect for the job, there's just one little snag that because they need to talk to each other and share files, they just won't work out. I've seen it. It's true. I don't think that's good. I don't think it's fair. I think that's kind of Microsoft's way of, at least in Office applications, of screwing over the competition. But I think that it does happen, so one must take that into account. But I think quite often I don't think the users really know what they actually need, and sometimes need to be retrained. And I don't mean retrained on the software, I mean retrained in the way that they're thinking about what they are actually needing to accomplish. Because half the time I don't think that they're understanding actually what they use in an application. They see all the buttons and they assume that any application with fewer buttons, therefore, must not be as good. And obviously that's not correct. And the larger question is, why are we teaching these applications to people? And I think I've always assumed that the automatic answer would be, well, job preparedness. We want to prepare them for the workforce. Not that I care about the workforce personally, but if it's a college or a school and their self-proclaimed purpose in life is to prepare people for the workforce, then they would, in theory, need to teach proprietary applications because that's what the workplaces are using. And I have heard the whole argument, well, I want to teach them concepts, not applications. And that's all great and everything, and it works until you get a student who's sitting there and you're teaching them concepts, but secretly in their own mind, all they're doing is clicking the same buttons that you're clicking, and that's what they've learned. This sequence equals this result. And that's not the concept. That's which buttons to press to get a certain result. So that does happen. That happens often enough. So you might be teaching concepts. That doesn't mean that's what people are learning. So I don't know that argument really holds very true necessarily. I love the idea, and I think in an ideal learning situation that would be what was happening, so that you've taught someone how to edit video and now they can apply it to whatever application they want to. but I don't think that's necessarily what people get out of a certain lesson or a certain lecture. Therefore, the only other reason really to keep pushing proprietary software, well, I guess two reasons, would be number one, because that's what the teachers know. And so if you're asking a bunch of teachers to suddenly teach a different application, you're asking them to invest a little bit of work and effort into learning something new that they're not familiar with. And secondly, you're asking the workplaces to change what they're using as well. So, because that's what all the people there know. I think optimistically and honestly, I think that as people go into schools and go into the workforce and are being taught these free things, the free software at home and among their friends and wherever we are getting the free software, then I think as they start to populate the new jobs and the new colleges and things like that, you know, the new crowd kind of comes in and starts doing that, I think that it's going to get in that way through the incoming people who know free software. I don't know that going in and saying, okay, everyone, put down your Photoshops and your Final Cuts and your Microsoft Offices and start using these. I'd love it to happen like that. I'd love it if it were possible. I just don't see it happening anytime soon. Just some random thoughts. I think the point of all that was that the teachers need to start teaching free software, and that's how we're all going to take over the world. Now let's take a coffee break. Well, it certainly is good to have coffee again. I didn't want to have coffee without you, so I actually didn't drink any coffee until I did this episode. Okay, no, not really. But I did try. Was really good coffee. I hope that you enjoy your cup. And speaking of cup, we're going to talk about cups. Well, actually, not so much about cups, but printing in general. The reason I'm going to talk about printing is because the last episode, of course, you'll recall, I spoke about printing, and I got a lot of good feedback about it, but I actually got a lot of questions about it as well, mostly about the underlying parts of all this printer stuff, as well as some questions about command line printing. Happens to be something that I actually just looked into fairly extensively for my screenplay work. The screenplay stuff that I write in Emacs, I find it easier to format and then print directly from the command line. It just kind of, it's easier that way because I'm working all in plain text anyway. And it's just kind of nice to, the way that I write the screenplays is in segments. I'm not going to go on too long about this, don't worry. In segments, and then I compile them all together, I cat them all together, pipe it through a print format command called PR, and then I send it over to LPR, which is the line printing something or another, and it prints it out. So that's how I do it. So I've actually looked into kind of the command line side of this fairly extensively, and simply because of my job and because of my work on the screenplay stuff, I've done quite a bit with printing configuration and stuff. Not to say that I'm an expert, so don't ask me too many more questions on the subject, because I probably don't know. But this is what I do know, and that is that printers come in three different varieties, more or less. Of course, actually, a lot more, but let's say that there are three different kinds of printers, or rather three different kinds of drivers that you could use to talk to a printer. One is PostScript. PostScript printers are very, very common now. More than likely, your printer, unless it's a line feed printer, whatever they're called, dot matrix, is probably a PostScript printer. So the Unix-y version of PostScript is GhostScript. That's GHOST, Ghost Script Printing. And you've probably seen this when you install something like GIMP or anything fancy like that. Usually it depends on Ghost Script, although, to be fair, usually Ghost Script is already installed, so you may not even notice that you're installing it. Next is Gutenprint. Gutenprint is a thing that kind of has benefited from the proliferation of very basic drivers among printers. So it's funny because you might find, especially on OS X, I don't know what it's like on the Windows world, but on OS X, you could find that the printer bundled with a printer, the driver bundled with a printer is, you know, and they were just talking about this on the last Tilts episode, actually, for episode 421. They were just talking about this driver package that comes with a printer. It's like 360 megabytes or something absurd like that, or 80 megabytes. And it's just one driver for that one printer. It's insane. You're just like, what on earth are they putting on my computer? Well, I don't know. And neither does Gutenprint. Gutenprint is, I don't know, let's just throw out a number, 20 megabytes, maybe 50, I don't know, maybe it's 80, whatever it is. It doesn't matter. It has support for 700 printers. So I don't care how big it is, it's worth it. 700 printers, one install. You grab Gutenprint from your repository, or you find it on your computer. Well, you don't even have to find it, to be honest, it's probably already there. But the point being, if it is on your Linux box, it is going to print to 700 different printers. So that is why when you plug in a printer to a Linux box, half the time it is just there. You open up CUPS to tell your computer, hey, I've got a printer connected. What do you think? The printer, the CUPS can look into Gutenprint and probably find the driver that you need already installed. The third driver sort that you might find is one from a manufacturer. Hey, believe it or not, some printer manufacturers make drivers for Linux, 32-bit, 64-bit, and you can possibly go to their site, go to their driver download section, and find the driver that you need for your GNU Linux box. And you would install it the same way that you normally install it. You know, I mean, if you download a package, it's going to be what? Like yum local install dot slash manufacturer driver dot RPM, or it's going to be aptitude install, I forget how you do it. No, it's dpkg-i, whatever, you know, big printer driver dot deb. So, however you do a local install, that's how you would install that driver. Otherwise, Gutenprint is probably the one that you're looking for, and then you're going to want to have the Ghost script support on the back end anyway, so you'll install that no matter what. So that's the driver side, and really it's that simple. I mean, typically you should have Ghostprint and you should have Gutenprint. 9 times out of 10 you're going to be okay. Some of those other times you'll have to go out and find the driver, and that's what I was talking about last time in the episode, the openprinting.org. That very, very frequently has great little drivers for you to use. Sometimes a printer is so generic and so universal and so nice that all it needs really is PostScript, or in the GNU Linux world, GhostScript, and all that you really need to install anything specific to that printer is a PPD file, and I don't remember what PPD stands for, I don't care. The manufacturer might distribute PPD files, or openprinting.org will have a PPD file for you. So you might not even need really a driver as such. You simply, as long as you've got GhostScript on the back end, it will talk to your printer. You should install the PPD file just so that the computer kind of knows all the different features that printer has and how to use those features, but it's usually a really, really small little, it's more like a specification file, from what I understand, than a driver, really. So all of those cases, it's pretty easy, right? GhostScript is probably on your computer already. If not, you can do a quick install of it. Gutenprint, again, probably on your computer if it's a very robust install. If not, simply go install GhostScript. And then the manufacturer driver, if it's not anywhere else, you can usually find the manufacturer driver, or I guess you could check your repository to see if there's some kind of separate driver there. For HP, for instance, there might actually be a driver specifically for that printer in your repository, but whatever. Those are the three ways that you're going to look for the support that your computer needs for that printer. And then I think I kind of went over last time, and if not, it's pretty simple, the whole CUPS configuration. Just FYI, CUPS actually has a printers.conf file in /etc. I think it might be /etc/cups/printers.conf. It might just be /etc/printers.conf. I don't really remember. but it's this file that I believe is automatically generated by cups. So you'd want to stop cups if you're going to actually edit it yourself. I don't know why you'd want to edit it, but you could do a less on it. And with cups running, you can do a less on it just to see what cups actually generates when you go through that front end. And it's a simple sort of XML-y kind of document. It just says that here's a printer, here's the printer name, and here's information about the printer. Here's the location, here's the make and the model, here's the device URI, the state that it's in, all different kinds of things that cups just kind of places in that configuration file. You might want to look at that if you've set up a printer through the cups web interface, because it will tell you things like the printer name. You can also look at that in cups, but I found it really, really simple when you're looking at the conf file. It simply says printer R1060, for instance. That was the Ricoh 1060 that I have access to at work. So that's what I named it in cups, so that's how the computer sort of refers to that printer. There might even be one called default printer R1060, or default printer R6000, the Ricoh 6000 that I've got access to. In that case, that's obviously the default printer, that if you say, okay, print, and you hit return a bunch of times without looking, it's going to pop out over there on the default printer, whichever printer that might be. So the question that I got a couple of times was, how do you get to those printers via the command line? The obvious answer, the one that people very frequently think of right away, is LPR, because that's the common one. That's the one we all know about. LPR, name of the file, sends it out to a printer. But hold on a minute now. How does the LPR know what printer to use? Well, that's the tricky part, slightly tricky part. One way to do to tell the system what its default printer is to go to cups, go to manage printers, and then select set default printer. It's in a drop-down menu. So you go to the printer that you want to be the default printer, you click on that printer, and then there should be a drop-down menu that says, I think it might just say, like, edit or something, but if you look in that drop-down menu, there is one selection that says set as default. That's one way to do it. You can also do it on the command line and simply use lpadmin. You have to be root. lpadmin, line printer admin, space dash d for default, space, in my case, it would be R1060, because that's the printer name, R1060. Now, me, myself, I like to avoid spaces in names, so I don't have any printer named Ricoh space 1060, or Ricoh space 6000, or HP space 1394, whatever. Thank goodness. If you have spaces in your name, I assume quoting it will probably solve the issue. Me, I'd go back to cups and rename the thing without spaces. Do whatever you want to, but LP admin space dash D space the name of the printer, that will get your system on the same page. It will set that printer name as the default printer. And at that point, you can simply invoke LPR to print any file that you want. So LPR space name of file will send the file to the default printer, which we just set as, in my case, the R1060. For me, when I'm printing things, I frequently want to make sure that the line breaks are nice and pretty, you know, that they don't go straight off the page, things like that. There's a handy little program called PR, as in print, I guess. And there's the default options for PR is fine. If you do a man PR, you'll get all kinds of different options. But literally, if you just do PR space file name and then pipe that to LPR, then suddenly the document that you want printed will be printed very nice and pretty over on the page. How pretty? Well, it'll have a header. It'll have the page number. It'll have, I think, a default footer possibly, but it will all fit on the page. It will be sure that a line break appears after a certain number of lines. I think the default is 66 lines, which is, as it turns out, what a letter size page fits onto it. I think it's 80 columns. You know, all the usual stuff. You can change all of that stuff. You can merge lines. You can change the page length. You can tell it the first page of the first line number. You can line you can number the lines, all kinds of different things that you can do. It's very flexible because it's all plain text. I think at one point I even, well, I know that I pipe a lot of this through SED for my screenplay stuff so that certain things in the footer and the header are replaced by new things, you know, so it's easy enough to do, it's plain text. But if it's just a quick, I just need to print this out and I want it to look nice, just do a PR space, name of file, pipe, LPR, it'll print a nicely formatted document to your default printer, simple as that. Okay, I think that's about the end of this season opener. I hope you enjoyed all the fluffy philosophical thought at the beginning and all the hardcore printing action at the end. This has been episode 0 of season 7 of the GNU World Order. You can reach me on the web at bogcastplanet.org/GNU World Order. You can find me on IM at notclatu@jabber.org. On IRC, on the Freenode network, as notclat2. You can email me at clat2@nimber.fsf.org or clat2@hackerpublicradio.org. Thanks for listening, and I will see you next time.
Divine revelation was given.